of over two dozen Palestinians. Regime forces also conduct new raid in occupied West Bank, killing two Palestinians, including a resistance commander. And Iran says that Israel's attack on a Syria embassy violated the immunity of diplomatic missions and necessitates legitimate defense to punish the aggressor. The Israeli military's unrelenting attacks on Gaza continue to claim more civilian lives. At least 29 people were killed when a home in central Gaza City was targeted in regime's fresh bombardment. Another 20 civilians lost their lives in Israeli strikes in other areas across the coastal sliver. More than 33,600 people have so far been killed in Gaza since Israel began its genocidal war back on October the 7th. Thousands are still missing. A Geneva-based human rights organization has estimated over 13,000 Gazans are unaccounted for. The Euro-Mediterranean Human Rights Monitor says many of those missing are either under rubble or been buried in indiscriminate mass graves. Earlier, we spoke to our correspondent Moti Abu Musabe in the city of Deir Abala in central Gaza. He says Israel continues to target residential buildings and has announced a limited ground offensive in the Nusayra refugee camp in northern Gaza.
Gaza City was under heavy bombardments over the last 24 hours. At least four residential buildings were destroyed to the ground by the intense Israeli airstrikes that were concentrated against a Zaytun neighborhood and a Daraj neighborhood at the same time. In the meantime, as you can see, as you know, that the Israeli warplanes also intensified their attacks against the central area of Gaza Strip. The Israeli artillery shelling has never stopped for a while since yesterday. So far, in addition to the continuous airstrikes that are still hitting the residential buildings and the houses, particularly in the northern parts of Nusayra refugee camp, where the Israeli military announced the beginning of a limited ground offensive against that area. We can say that this area, particularly Al-Mughraga neighborhood and Al-Zahra neighborhood, they are subjected to heavy bombardments amid fierce clashes erupted between the Palestinian resistance and the Israeli occupation forces. According to multiple eyewitnesses, the Israeli occupation forces detonated several residential buildings, like what happened in Khan Yunis City and in Gaza City and in the northern part of Gaza Strip. Dozens of the Palestinian residential buildings and houses were detonated and blasted using the explosive devices by the Israeli occupation forces. We are talking about a catastrophic situation right now in the northern part of Gaza, in the northern part of Nusayra refugee camp, knowing that this area and that camp is completely overcrowded and overwhelmed with the Palestinian evacuees and the displaced Palestinians who were forcibly expelled out of their residential buildings and neighborhoods in Gaza City and the northern part of Gaza Strip.
News review program where we get in-depth in one of the day's top stories. The UN Security Council has expressed grave concern over an Israeli airstrike that killed seven members of a U.S.-based charity, World Central Kitchen, earlier this month in the Gaza Strip. The 15-member body called for a full, transparent probe into this incident. Council also said Israel must do more to improve aid delivery into the besieged territory. Now, the statement called for immediate lifting of all barriers to humanitarian aid delivery. International aid groups say that Gaza is progressively being made unfit for human life and has passed the threshold of absolute horror. They say famine is imminent and nowhere in Gaza currently has access to sufficient assistance and services. And a UNICEF car came under fire in northern Gaza earlier this week on its way to deliver aid to malnourished children. And that was the latest incident of targeting aid groups by Israeli forces in Gaza, where people are already starving due to the regime's restrictions. Now let's take a listen to a UNICEF spokesperson explain how that attack took place.
I was in that car that was hit. It was waiting at a holding point just south of the Wadi Gaza checkpoint, where we are often instructed to wait before being called through the checkpoint. We were waiting there as instructed, and gunfire broke out in the vicinity. It seemed to be coming from the direction of the checkpoint towards civilians, who then turned and fled from the checkpoint. Luckily, myself and my colleagues, we were all safe, but this just underscores how dangerous it is for humanitarian aid workers in Gaza at the moment, that incidents like this continue to happen when they absolutely shouldn't. See, we decided to go ahead because it was such a critical mission, with nutrition products for the children who are malnourished in the north of Gaza, among other things. Unfortunately, after deciding that we would go ahead, we were still delayed. We waited at that holding point for at least another 2 hours before deciding that the mission was no longer feasible, because we didn't have enough time, even if we were given the green light, to go up, conduct all of our activities, and then get. It's tragic to see anybody suffering from malnutrition, which is such a painful condition, let alone in a place where malnutrition was almost non-existent before October, and it's now skyrocketed in the north of Gaza because of disruptions to food production, but also because of restrictions on aid access to that area. We've really struggled to get up there with aid, and as a result, we know that children are dying of malnutrition there. At least 23 children have reportedly died at the Kamal Adwan Hospital, which is where we were trying to bring these nutrition treatments on Tuesday.
Joining us now for the program is John Stepling, author and commentator, joining us out of Inderøy, Norway, and Fra Hughes, journalist, and author, and activist, joining us from Belfast. Gentlemen, I'd like to welcome you both to the program here. I guess we'll start with you, Fra, there in Belfast. Now, Fra, I mean, over 14,000 children have perished out of 33,600-plus people that have died over the last 6.5 months in Gaza, over 10,000 women, and that doesn't count the thousands upon thousands of children and women maimed, starved to death, and still starving as we speak. And what does the Security Council do after all the times it's failed to do anything to help these people? It's showing what now? Grave and deep concerns. Your initial thoughts.
Yes, well, they're certainly not brave, and deep concerns would be my initial thoughts, because there's nothing brave about the United Nations Security Council. I think on one level, I'm sad to say, it's a complete distraction. What we're having is a political vacuum, which is being filled by words of good intent and a grave concern and nothing else. The UN is a toothless tiger, has been described by many other commentators. I think what I have, like, a model when it comes to political institutions and the politicians themselves. Don't listen to what they say, watch what they do. The United Nations is doing nothing. This whole idea of the starvation and the famine that is running rampant in Gaza is a form of collective punishment. It is a war crime. It is being used to subjugate and subdue the Palestinian people. All we appear to have on one side is the UN saying more aid must go in, along with the hypocrisy of the United States of America, the EU, and Britain. And on the other hand, we have the Israelis saying we are going to flood, absolutely flood, Gaza with aid. And then they open fire on the UNICEF convoys trying to bring aid to dying children in the hospitals in northern Gaza. They killed the 7 international aid workers, 3 of whom were security guards, which may have had connections to the British security apparatus. And that puts into question the whole notion that some of these NGOs are there for the benefit of the people on the ground, and not for the benefit of the intelligence services that are helping to target those very people on the ground with the Israeli combined command centers that has the British and the Americans and the Israelis all totally involved in the destruction, in the what you would call the scorched earth policy, the destruction of all these buildings that we're witnessing, the murder of people bringing aid, the people trying to receive that aid, and the fact that they're trying to prevent the aid getting in the first place as a negotiation action with the resistance in Gaza, but also as part of what I can only describe as Zionist final plan for Gaza, which is the destruction of all the infrastructure, all the homes, all the hospitals, all the schools, all the sewage, all the water treatment, all the wells and the fresh water, leave it totally uninhabitable. And then when they reach that point, they will try and force the people to leave without offering them a rate of return.
Thank you, John Sepley. Welcome to the program here. Now, John, the Israeli regime, do you feel in your heart of hearts that attacking aid workers, aid convoys, humanitarian missions are deliberate and systemic when it comes to the Israeli regime?
Well, of course they're deliberate. And look, Israel admits they're deliberate. I mean, you have to understand there is this enormous disconnect between the reality on the ground, the genocide that is taking place, and the rhetoric coming from Western institutions and Western governments, places like the United Nations, who issue admonition that Israel improve delivery of aid. They're blocking delivery of aid. It's not a question of improving it. They're preventing delivery of aid. They admit they're preventing delivery of aid. Israeli politicians are bragging about the genocide, are proud of the war crimes. It does not take much effort to find proof of this. You just have to listen to what they say. The war crimes, the list of war crimes would take an hour to calculate here. It is an aside, it is a horrific thing that anyone for a very long time. And the government, of course, is complicit in this. Biden has an election, so he opts vote and meant to
John.
Frustration with nonsense. Yeah.
All right, gentlemen, stay safe to both of you, and thank you for joining us on the program here. John Stepling there, author and commentator, joining us out of Inderøy, Norway, and Fra Hughes, journalist, author, and activist, joining us out of Belfast. This brings us to the conclusion of this segment of News Review program. Thank you for tuning in, and goodbye for now. Israeli forces have killed two Palestinians in their latest raids in the occupied West Bank. Israeli troops raided the city of Tubas in the northeast West Bank. They killed a member of the Hamas resistance movement after they opened fire on his vehicle. The man is identified as Mohammed Rasul Daragme. He was the son of senior Hamas member Omar Daragme, who passed away in an Israeli prison back in October. To the south of Tubas, Israeli forces also killed a Palestinian during a military raid into the Al-Fara camp. Regimes intensified its attacks throughout the occupied West Bank since it launched its war on Gaza back in early October. Since then, at least 462 Palestinians have been killed throughout the West Bank. And now Israeli forces have also launched a raid into other areas of the West Bank. Our correspondent in Ramallah, Mona Candiel, earlier joined us with the details.
We were speaking about Israeli military incursions to Tul Karim and to areas in Al Khalil, but now we are speaking about Israeli military raids to Tul Karim, to Al Khalil, to Jenin, to Nablus, to Al Amari refugee camp in Ramallah, as well as to settlers' aggression in the area near Nablus. So the Israeli forces had, as usual, expanded their military incursions to several areas across the occupied West Bank. In Tul Karim, the Israeli forces stormed the area of Shweke and arrested at least five Palestinians from there, including one former or ex-Palestinian prisoner. In Al Khalil, the Israeli troops stormed Ithna and Beit Umar, attacked Palestinians, raided the homes, it questioned the people there. The exact number of the Palestinians who had been detained is not known, those who were arrested in the areas of Al-Khalil. The Israeli forces had also stormed the town of Aurif, south Nablus, and they attacked Palestinians there. They forced their way into the homes away. In addition to Aurif, the Israeli forces stormed the village of Azzoun, east Qalqilia. In the last 4 days, let's say, the Israeli forces had been storming the villages of Azzoun and Jayus almost on a daily basis. A Palestinian had carried out a shooting several days ago, and the Israeli forces are still searching for this Palestinian who carried out the shooting at Israeli soldiers and settlers in an area between Azzoun and Jayus near Qalqilia. And every day the Israeli forces are storming these areas, raiding the Palestinians' homes and questioning them, and they're looking for this Palestinian.
Iran's president says the Israeli regime's genocide in the Gaza Strip is a great grief for Islamic countries and all freedom lovers around the world. In a phone call with his Pakistani counterpart, Asif Ali Zardari, Ebrahim Raisi called on freedom-seeking and independent countries to make a concerted effort to put pressure on Tel Aviv to stop its atrocities. Elsewhere in his remarks, the Iranian president touched upon hegemonic power schemes to drive a wedge between the Iranian and Pakistani nations. He called for closer cooperation between the two nations, namely in the war on terrorism, to boost mutual partnership and foil enemies' plots. Zardari in turn echoed President Raisi's remarks, demanding closer security cooperation between Tehran and Islamabad. Iran says Israel's recent attack on its embassy in Syria, which violated the immunity of diplomatic missions, necessitates legitimate defense with the objective of punishing the aggressor. Foreign Minister Hossein Amri Abdullahian made the remark in separate phone calls with his German, British, and Australian counterparts. He stressed the punishment is necessary as Israel has shown total disregard for international law and the Vienna Conventions, while the UN Security Council has been unable to condemn the terrorist attack. Iran's top diplomat said only way to restore peace to the region is to end Israel's genocide and war crimes in Gaza and the West Bank. He also urged his counterparts to explicitly condemn Israel's terrorist attack. Amir Abdullahian said controlling Israel's warmongering and its deranged leaders is a prerequisite to sustain security in West Asia. That's it for your latest, everyone. Thanks for tuning in, and bye-bye for now.
Iran. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
A senior Iranian lawmaker has said,
contrary to Washington's claims, America's
President Raisi has emphasized that
U.S. sanctions have failed to extract concessions from Tehran.
Iran Today.
On a tense afternoon in Damascus on April 1st, Israel carried out a targeted airstrike on a building nestled within the Iranian embassy complex, sparking heightened tensions in the already volatile region. As smoke billowed from the damaged structure, questions swirled about the potential repercussions of this brazen act of aggression, casting a shadow of uncertainty over West Asia's geopolitical landscape. But why should Israel decide out of the blue to bomb Iran's embassy? What would be Tehran's reaction? Will the Islamic Republic seek direct and immediate retaliation? Or will it respond in its own fashion? Could Israel's strike be the tipping point into a wider regional conflict? These and more on this episode of Iran Today. In the past few months, Israel has assassinated at least 18 members of the Quds Force, among them four senior commanders who were veterans of West Asia wars. But the airstrike in Damascus was far out of the ordinary, both in targeting so many senior figures at once and in hitting a diplomatic building, which is normally considered off-limits in conflicts. This is Dr. Hossein Ajorlu, a senior expert on international relations based in Tehran.
این نکته هم تازه خدمت شما عرض کنم که مکانی که مورد هدف قرار گرفته کنسولگریه.
It's noteworthy that a place attacked by the Israeli regime is Iran's consulate. If attacking an embassy is a violation of international law, attacking a consulate is even a more flagrant violation. Because it's a place to give public services to ordinary people. So attacking such places is both a violation of international laws and human rights.
Among the seven Iranians assassinated were General Mohammad Reza Zahedi, one of Iran's most senior commanders in its Islamic Revolution Guard Corps, and Mohammad Hadi Haji Rahimi, his deputy. Mr. Abbas Haji Najjari told us about another aspect of Israel's attack.
Well, those who were martyred in the attack were Iran's official military advisors who were on Syrian soil in full coordination with the Syrian government. The Israeli regime violated international laws by targeting Iran's diplomatic mission, but also by violating the national sovereignty of Syria. Syria is not at war with Israel, so the regime cannot take such military action in the country. Iran reserves the right to target Israel directly or indirectly, when and how Tehran will decide.
Martyr Zahedi oversaw the IRGC's operations in Syria, Lebanon, and Palestinian territories and fought on the front line with Hezbollah against Israel during the 2006 war, making him the most senior commander to be assassinated after martyr Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani. General Zahedi was attending a meeting with his officers and members of Islamic Jihad at the compound when the attack occurred.
What the Israeli regime did was an example of state terrorism, which is not even allowed in war conditions. It is not allowed even when two sides are at war with each other. The two sides of a conflict should abide by rules of engagement stipulated in international laws. So terrorism is a flagrant violation of international laws because you assassin a person without putting them on trial. It's totally unacceptable. On a higher level, what Israel did was meant to destabilize peace in the region, which itself is again against international laws. So Israel's attack on Iran's consulate building is illegal from different aspects.
Experts have described the attack as unprecedented and a dangerous escalation that threatens to finally tip Israel's six-month-long war with Hamas into a wider regional conflict. A day after Israeli airstrikes destroyed Iran's consulate building in Damascus, leader of the Islamic Revolution Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei declared, "The evil regime will be punished by our brave men." We will make them regret this crime and other ones by God's will. A few days later on Friday, Hezbollah Secretary General Sayed Hassan Nasrallah said in a televised speech, "Be certain that Iran's response to the targeting of its Damascus consulate is inevitable." Iran has strongly condemned Israel's bombing of the building in the Iranian embassy complex in Damascus, denouncing it as a blatant act of aggression and a violation of international law. The Islamic Republic has vowed to retaliate against Israel for the assassinating of senior commanders and other officers of its elite Quds force. Yet it has not disclosed the details of its planned retaliation or the timing of it. In several cities across Iran, including the capital Tehran, as well as Tabriz and Isfahan, large crowds of protesters gathered waving Palestinian and Iranian flags and demanding revenge. "Our brave men will punish the Zionist regime," General Hossein Salami, the commander-in-chief of Iran's Islamic Revolution Guard Corps, told the crowd in Tehran. "We warn that no act by any enemy against our holy system will go unanswered, and the art of the Iranian nation is to break the power of empires." Mr. Najjari said, "Unlike what it might seem, Iran's retaliatory response would contribute to peace in the region."
Iran's retaliatory attack or attacks might have a deterrent effect. If the Israelis come to this conclusion that their attacks are not cost-free, they might be more careful in the future. On the contrary, if we don't respond, it might embolden them not only to carry out attacks on Iran, but also on other countries in the region. Under such circumstances, we might, ironically, have further escalation.
Israel has placed its military on high alert, canceled leave for combat units, and recalled some reservists to air defense units. At the same time, 7 Israeli embassies have been evacuated in response to the potential threat of an Iranian retaliatory attack. The regime has deployed GPS jamming systems within Tel Aviv to safeguard against potential aerial attacks by Iran. The United States is anticipating a significant Iranian attack on U.S. or Israeli assets in a week or so.
"Look, Israel's attack on Iran's consulate cannot be described as a military achievement or military muscle flexing. An F-35 jet fighter targets a diplomatic building from the Golan Heights. So it is not correct to say that Israel has challenged Iran in military terms. It is not even correct to compare these two together. Israel might be at its maximum capacity, on par with Palestinian groups in terms of military prowess, and Iran does not need to attack Israel to prove its military superiority. If it attacks, however, it is for other considerations."
There are precedents for a forceful response by Iran. 4 years ago, after the United States assassinated the chief of the Quds Force, Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani, Iran fired missiles at U.S. bases in Iraq, injuring more tens of troops. Dr. Fouad Izadi of Tehran Faculty of World Studies had more to say.
How likely is the escalation of tensions?
Israelis have any sense left in them. They should take the response that Iran has and end it at that time. They should not respond to Iranians' response. If they do, this will escalate. Because, you know, even when General Soleimani was killed, Iran hit the American base in Iraq. And if Americans had responded, Iran had plans for Americans' response. Americans were realized that continuing with that line was not good for them. So after they got hit at the base in Iraq, they stopped. They didn't continue. And Israelis should learn something from Americans. If they learn that, then you are not going to have serious escalation. If they continue with that practice, then we wouldn't know where the end is, because Iran cannot just get hit by Israelis and just live with that. That's not possible.
In the words of Lieutenant General Alexis Grinch Grinkovich, the top U.S. Air Force commander in West Asia, "From a military perspective, the biggest concern that I have is, does this lead to some sort of regional escalation? adding, "I do continue to assess that the Iranians are not interested in a broader regional conflict. They're not interested in war with Israel, war with the United States, or war with anybody else right now." That said, Iranian officials have vowed to retaliate against the unwarranted attack on their sovereignty and interests. Iran's foreign ministry spokesman Nasser Kanani said, "Iran reserves the right to carry out a reaction and will decide on the type of response and the punishment of the aggressor." In your opinion, what could be Tehran's best response?
The Islamic Republic is not after war. All these diplomatic messages Tehran is sending here and there show that Iran wants to resolve tensions diplomatically. Moreover, when it comes to national interest, you must be patient. A tit-for-tat policy is not advisable when it comes to national security. Launching missiles is the easiest thing to do, but dealing a fatal blow to the enemy needs patience and deliberation. The Islamic Republic has shown that it responds to all threats, but not right away, but in due time. To borrow from an Arab journalist, Iranians are patient people who take revenge in the right place at the right time.
For centuries, diplomatic premises have been afforded special protections. Diplomats get immunity from prosecution in their host country, and embassy buildings are often viewed as a sanctuary for their nation's citizens. They cannot be entered by the host country's police without the permission of the diplomatic staff, and often become refugees for expatriates in times of war. So attacks on diplomatic compounds carry particular weight, both in law and in the popular imagination. Shortly after the attack, in addition to Syria, other Muslim countries like Iraq, Jordan, Oman, Pakistan, Qatar, Saudi Arabia, and the United Arab Emirates were among the first to condemn the attack. Cuba, Venezuela, China, and Russia also slammed right away the Israeli airstrike on Iran's embassy. Russia's foreign ministry said in a statement, "We strongly condemn this unacceptable attack against the Iranian consular mission in Syria." However, the so-called flag bearers of international law and conventions in the West have kept mum about Israel's flagrant violation of international law. Mr. Mohammad Qadiri, an Iranian political analyst, told us about the psychological warfare waged just after the attack.
Right after Israel's attack on Iran's consulate, all social accounts affiliated to Tel Aviv waged psychological warfare against the Islamic Republic. A few days ago, I came across a tweet by Netanyahu, which was in Farsi. It was something like this: "Please put aside your strategic patience and take your severe revenge. He is desperately trying to both humiliate and instigate the Islamic Republic. This is clearly a psychological game. Again, what they're doing is a reaction to the fatal blows they've already received, and they cannot compensate by targeting some Iranian assets. Needless to say, Iran will hit back, but not the way the regime expects. It will do so with the least possible harm to the country."
This is Iran Today. Iran Today is broadcast every week on Fridays and Saturdays. This series analyzes major political, economic, cultural, and social events concerning Iran. So don't miss the opportunity to listen to Iran Today on IRIB English Radio.
There's plenty more to be said, but first a quick media review to give other outlets a chance to get a word in.
Hello everyone, welcome to the news section of the program. Here, we'll go over some important news headlines. Most Persian Gulf states condemned the attack on the Iranian embassy complex in Syria. An escalation is what they fear most. The Atlantic Council writes, from the perspective of many governments around the world, Israel moved up the escalation ladder when it raised Iran's embassy annex in Damascus on April 1st. Interestingly, the first country to condemn the airstrike was the United Arab Emirates. The leadership in Abu Dhabi has grave concerns about being caught up in any escalation of regional hostilities, which have been exacerbated since the Gaza war began in October 2023 and spread to Lebanon, Yemen, and elsewhere. The fact that the UAE normalized relations with Israel in 2020 via the Abraham Accords leaves the Persian Gulf country increasingly vulnerable to the Middle East conflict dynamics. U.S. tells Iran it had no involvement in Israel's strike. Axios writes, the U.S. told Iran that it had no involvement or advanced knowledge of an Israeli strike on a diplomatic compound in Syria that killed a senior Iranian general, according to a U.S. official. The rare message shows the Biden administration is deeply concerned that the Israeli strike could lead to a regional escalation and the resumption of attacks by pro-Iranian militia against U.S. forces. Israel and U.S. are on alert for Iran to strike back at Israel. New York Times writes, the Israeli airstrike in Damascus that killed seven Iranian commanders was an unusually harsh blow, and officials say Iran is determined to respond, raising fears of a war. U.S. military analysts assess that it is more likely that Iran would strike Israel itself than attack U.S. troops in the region, including in Iraq and Syria. Israel terrified of Iran's response to concealed attack. Iran's ambassador to Syria, Hossein Akbari, says that the Tel Aviv regime is frightened of Iran's response to the Israeli attack on the country's consulate in Damascus last week. Meher News writes, the senior Iranian diplomat made the comments while speaking at a ceremony at Iran's embassy in Damascus on the occasion of the International Quds Day, saying that Iran filed a complaint against Tel Aviv at the United Nations Security Council after the Israeli regime targeted the building of the country's consulate in Damascus and clearly violated all international law. Akbari underlined that since the United Nations Security Council failed to take necessary actions to prevent the repetition of such horrible crimes by the Zionist regime, Iran reserves its right to respond. Thank you for joining us in this section. Please stay tuned for the main narrative. Israel has long targeted Iran's military installations in Syria, but the April 1st attack was the first time it targeted the embassy compound itself.
The consequences of Israel's bombing of the building in the Iranian embassy complex in Damascus could be significant and wide-ranging. It could escalate tensions between Israel and Iran, potentially leading to retaliatory attacks from Iran against Israeli targets. This escalation could further destabilize an already volatile region and increase the risk of wider conflict. Moreover, the incident could strain diplomatic relations between Israel and other countries, particularly those with close ties to Iran. It may also lead to increased international scrutiny and condemnation of Israel's actions, potentially impacting its standing on the global stage. So the question is, why did Israel take such a risky action? Isn't it too big a gamble for too tiny a regime?
Why should Israel do this now? Basically, in what context did this attack take place?
Netanyahu realizes that as soon as this war is over, he will lose his prime ministership. Mm-hmm. So he wants to prolong the war. He wants to prolong the genocide in Gaza. He wants to expand the war to Syria and Lebanon and Iran. That's all he's interested in, to make sure that he remains prime minister. He's willing to kill as many Israelis and Iranians and Syrians and Lebanese and as many people that needs to be killed. He doesn't care. He wants to be prime minister. And I think a lot of people realize that. And U.S. support for Netanyahu in the manner they have done in the last 6 months is, again, shows that people who are sitting in Washington don't realize what's good for them.
Mr. Qadiri told us that the attack is just Netanyahu's political sleight of hand.
It seems that the Israeli regime targeted Iran's consulate in Damascus in order to get away from public pressure coming from inside the occupied territories. After all, the regime is under relentless pressure as it has achieved no victory against the Palestinian resistance groups. Netanyahu has failed to achieve his stated goals so far. He said that he would seek the elimination of Hamas and the complete occupation of the Gaza Strip. The Israeli regime has just targeted defenseless people in Gaza, mostly women and children, which is not something to brag about. Last but not least, Netanyahu has not managed to release the Israelis held captive by Hamas and other resistance groups. So the Israeli Prime Minister is seeking to change the playground by doing such frenzied things, which are not correct either politically or militarily.
Israel's recent attack on Iran's embassy, coupled with the regime's recent destructive actions in Gaza, has intensified global concerns about Israel's approach to conflict resolution and its impact on regional stability. The targeted strike on Iran's diplomatic mission not only signals a dangerous escalation of hostilities between the two sides, but also raises questions about Israel's broader strategic objectives.
What is happening right now in the occupied territories is threatening the very existence of the Israeli regime. It's a matter of life and death for the regime. That's while up until October the 7th, the regime used to be full of itself, considering itself to be the epitome of power and success. Up to that moment, the regime used to brag about its great deterrence in all aspects, such as security, military, cybersecurity, and intelligence. But this masquerade has now been shattered into pieces, a humiliating debacle for the regime. So it is quite understandable why the Israelis are behaving this way.
By attacking a diplomatic facility, Israel has crossed a significant line in international norms, further solidifying its reputation as a pariah regime. As the world waits to see how Tehran will respond to this provocation, the specter of direct confrontation looms large. Yet it's not easy to Tehran's mind.
What is Israel looking for?
ایالات متحده آمریکا در چند وقت اخیر یه چیزی نشون داده که حامی رژیم صهیونیستی است.
The United States of America has shown over and over again that it supports Israel unconditionally. We have seen this even after all the regime's genocidal operations. But the Israelis want even more support from Washington. They want the U.S. to directly support their interest by, let's say, dispatching its troops to the battlefield. The Israelis think if they manage to drag Tehran to the war, the Americans would get themselves engaged directly. But I would like to say that the Islamic Republic is acting very cleverly. The way Tehran is responding shows that it's fully aware of the whole game. So Israel wants to transform its war with Hamas into an international war against the resistance front, but to no avail.
The recent attack on Iran's diplomatic mission by Israel raises concerns about the regime's potential efforts to expand the scope of the conflict, dragging both Iran and U.S. into it, in fact pitting the two against each other.
You know, Israel has been wanting to have a war between Iran and the United States for many years, dating back to the 1990s. They want to have a military confrontation between Iran and the United States. They want to fight Iran using American soldiers. That's what they want. And they are hoping by attacking Iranian consulate, maybe they can start that war. So that's one aim they have.
Some believe the embattled prime minister of the regime is acting as the madman. The madman theory is a political strategy where a leader deliberately portrays themselves as irrational and unpredictable to intimidate their adversaries. It is often used to gain leverage in negotiations or conflicts. By appearing erratic and volatile, Netanyahu may hope to instill fear and uncertainty in Iran's decision makers, leading them to reconsider their stance on certain issues. But the chances done seem to be high enough.
They want to say we are strong, we can do anything, we are above all international law. They call it the madman theory. We are madmen. We can engage in any type of genocide, we can engage in any type of violation of international law. This is the new normal. This is what the Israeli leaders are saying. The new normal is Israelis can do anything and they can get away with anything. And so the world needs to get used to that. The good news is that the more engaged they engage in this type of illegal activities, the more the genocide in Gaza continues, the deeper they get into this mess that they got themselves into. Now they have gotten themselves into a bigger mess, and now they're confronting Iran, which is a big mistake, because Iranian military capability is quite extensive, and Iranian leaders, I believe, have decided to respond to this grave violation of international law and the killing of Iranian generals and other personnel that they had on the ground in the conflict.
The desperate attack on Iran's embassy can yet reveal cracks within the Israeli regime. Political leaders in Israel may also use tensions with Iran to rally public support and divert attention from domestic issues.
اشخاصی مثل نتانیاهو و کابینه دست راستی اون.
People like Netanyahu and his extremist cabinet desperately need war. If you look at the short history of the Israeli regime, you will find out that after crushing defeats, the sitting prime minister and his men are usually put on trial or find their political future completely ruined. Netanyahu knows that his days are numbered, and sooner or later he will be kicked off the Israeli political stage. So he is trying to prolong the war, hoping that he might be able to achieve some victories in war, so as to increase his chances for survival in the political sphere of the regime. At the same time, Netanyahu has found himself against a nullified front in the region. Almost all the countries in the region are critical of the regime's genocide in Gaza. By introducing a new actor, namely Iran, to the theater of Gaza, Netanyahu wants to cause division in the unified front. After all, Iran has both friends and foes in the region, and Netanyahu is seeking to capitalize on this issue to his own interest.
Since October 7th, Israel has lost its proclaimed reputation as a regime with an invincible army. In a series of blatant, insane, and destructive moves, Israel has just escalated tensions to its own detriment. These actions paint Israel as a global pariah, ready to do anything to survive. As the clock ticks, the world watches anxiously, wondering how Tehran will respond to Israel's aggression.
That's all for today. Thank you from the whole team. Please do join us again to see what else is on. Till next time, take care.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
Faqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked
the Holy Prophet of Islam is the example
of
self-purification is the most significant
factor.
Imamat is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. Welcome to another episode of the program Ulama's Speech. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short Farsi speech by Hujjatul Islam Qaraati. Please stay tuned.
یک روسی که اسلام نداره یک کتابی نوشته.
There is a book written by a Russian author about the benefits of fasting for curing different diseases. In that book, he proves that through hunger and thirst, people can find remedy to most of their physical ailments. Also, Hazrat Fatima al-Zahra stated, fasting is the only worshipping of Allah that has no outer manifestation. This means that no one can see the hunger and thirst of a person. This is why it is among the best worshipping acts to Allah.
زهرا سلام الله علیها فرمود روزه برای اینکه کار بینام کردن.
Also, Hazrat Fatima al-Zahra continues, fasting is an act which is done anonymously. This means that all the worshipping acts are labeled with an external behavior or movement. The only deed that no one will understand without telling them is fasting. Also, fasting is a good lesson for those who want to know about their future life on the Day of Judgment, because there will be hunger and thirst over there too. On the heavens, there is a gate where only those who fast can enter. Therefore, bearing with hunger and thirst will be rewarded by Allah in the other world. Also, we must not limit fasting to the holy month of Ramadan, and after this month, we can at least fast for several days during a month to benefit the most from its positive effects, both for our spirituality and physicality. Thank you very much, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio Call of Islam page, for listening to this episode of the program Ulama's Speech, which was the English translation of a short Farsi speech by Hujjatul Islam Qaraati. To find out more about this program, please log on to our website, parstoday.ir, Call of Islam page. We leave you in Allah's care and goodbye. Thank you.
comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Israel strikes a home in central Gaza city, taking the life